Okay, the House Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. We do not have quorum just yet, but we do have some presentations from the first bill we'll have up this morning. So when we do get quorum, I will officially move House File 401 to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. But until then, we will go forward with the presentation. Representative Fenton, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Fenton, Kelly Fenton, for House File 501. What this bill is appropriations to voice response suicide prevention as well as the Text for Life. Members of the committee, you know, when my daughter was about 10 years old, I was driving her to a party and we came across what was a suicide. Somebody literally drove their car to the overpass and literally got out and jumped over. And it raised a lot of questions with my daughter, questions I wasn't really comfortable answering at the time for a 10-year-old. But I did say something to her. No matter how bad it is, no matter what happens, just know there are always people that love you and somebody out there you could talk to. And after she absorbed that for a while, she asked, what happens if there's nobody around? So this is where House File 501 comes in. And I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Eastwood, to tell you about the work they do. I've had the pleasure to actually tour the facility. While I was there, I saw the call center in action. And it's astounding the type of work that these members of the organization do. So with that, Mr. Eastwood.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Eastwood. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matthew Eastwood, and I'm the CEO of Canvas Health, a community mental health center located in Oakdale, Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Fenton and the co-authors for House File 501. Canvas Health was started as a nonprofit community mental health center in Washington County almost 50 years ago. We now offer over 35 clinic and community-based programs in Washington County and across the entire metro area. In addition, we offer statewide voice response and text response crisis services. I'm here today to testify on HF 501 appropriating funding to stabilize the voice response suicide prevention and mental health crisis response program and expand the statewide text message crisis response program. These services are provided through Crisis Connection, a telephone and text response center located in Ridgefield, Minnesota. Crisis Connection was founded in 1969 and was acquired by Canvas Health in 2010. We presently provide immediate crisis access to persons at risk of suicide or harming others, and we have a mental health crisis with a mission to create a place in which no one in crisis will ever be alone. Both the voice response and text response services are staffed by qualified professional and trained volunteer counselors who respond 24 hours a day, 365 days a year to individual inquiries. All crisis counselors are certified in ASSIST, which is Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training and Evidence-Based Practice. Services are free and confidential to the callers and easily accessible to anyone located in Minnesota. Trained counselors triage, stabilize, and assist callers in reaching a place of emotional and physical safety. Counselors refer individuals to available community resources where they're able to receive the long-term support and therapy and other services that they may need. Crisis Connection is the only crisis center in the state of Minnesota that's accredited by the American Association of Suicidology and Contact USA. We're the only response to all voice response calls for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline for calls originating in Minnesota. We currently administer the Minnesota Gambling Helpline, the Sowing Seeds of Hope Rural Line on behalf of the state of Minnesota. In addition, we have multiple incoming text lines, including the Text for Life program. These other lines include the University of Minnesota Crisis Text Line and the Minnesota Gambling Text Line. We deliver services through a combination of 26 professional staff and over 100 volunteers who offer approximately 12,000 hours of their time every year. We contribute to community well-being by responding in the following ways. In 2016, we provided almost 36,000 telephone conversations to people in crisis and responded to nearly, or had had 11,000 text conversations. Those 11,000 text conversations equate to over 400,000 individual text messages. Over 6,000 of the people we dealt with viewed themselves as being at high risk of suicide. 26,000 of them stated they were in a mental health crisis. 397 of those people, more than one a day, were referred through 911 to law enforcement and emergency medical professionals. We made over 1,500 referrals for mobile crisis, and we referred over 13,000 people to local community-based mental health substance abuse services. We have significant brand recognition. We're often marketed by the media, by counties, by the state, and by private providers. As you know, according to the Minnesota Department of Health, the number of suicides in Minnesota has steadily grown over the past decade. It has continued to increase, and it represents a serious public safety and public health issue. According to the Minnesota Center for Health Statistics, suicide was the ninth leading cause of death in 2013. In 2014, 683 Minnesotans died by suicide, with an age-adjusted suicide rate just slightly below the national average. Tragically, American Indian youth in our community between the ages of 10 and 24 have the highest age-adjusted rate of suicide in the state at 30.7. They are more than three times as likely to die by suicide as other white peers. In addition, we have found that, and statistics point out, that men in the age group of 50 to 64 are the second highest age-adjusted group rate of suicide at 29.5 per 100,000. Research shows us that 90% of these people have an underlying mental health or chemical health issue that needs treatment. We know that behind each of these suicides is a story of a loved one, a neighbor, a friend, a colleague, a family member. And for these individuals, not only is the loss shocking, painful, and unexpected, but the grief that ensues can be intense, complex, and long-term. The total effects of suicide, of death by suicide, can be felt across communities and across generations. We know these deaths can be prevented. We know that intervention works. We know that treatment works. We can help solve that problem. The request before you really contains two parts. It's support for the voice response service and the text response service. The voice response service does not receive base funding from the state of Minnesota to operate. In 2016, we received $8,487 from the Department of Agriculture for the Sowing Seeds of Hope rural line, and $125,000 from the Department of Human Services for the Gambling Helpline. In addition, we responded to over 9,000 calls for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and received $3,500 from SAMHSA for that work. Other funding for voice response comes from a small group of counties and entities who purchase telephonic services. The voice response service has experienced regular losses over the entire time that Canvas Health has owned them. These losses total over $900,000 at this time and are, in the long run, unsustainable for an agency of our size. This bill would move the funding structure to the state, similar to how the text service is funded, and anticipates a call answer rate would increase to 50,000 calls per year. These funds would sustain the voice response operation from now and into the future, ensuring the service would continue. Thanks to the efforts of Chairman Schumacher and others, the text response services did receive $1.125 million of funding during the 2015 legislative session. And while we greatly appreciate that and have been able to do a lot of good work with that, that amount was actually below the original request and less than we anticipated it would take to cover the entire state of Minnesota. And that is what we have found to be true. However, with these funds, we have been able to provide text response services and hire regional coordinators to cover 54 counties and all of the tribal nations in the state of Minnesota. The proposal before you today would increase the availability of Text for Life regional coordinators to conduct education and outreach to the central quarter of the state. I believe you have a handout that shows you that in your packet. These regional coordinators focus on suicide prevention strategies, mental health education and awareness, and helping communities understand how to access mental health and crisis resources. The use of regional coordinators is targeted at serving school-age youth who commonly use text messaging rather than telephone as a way to communicate. This proposal expands the use of regional coordinators to be statewide and provides the necessary capacity within the text center to accommodate thousands of additional text conversations. It's anticipated the greater text volume will be created by the increased awareness generated through the regional coordinators' work. Mr. Chair and members, I thank you for this opportunity to come before you this morning. We consideration of House File 501. This concludes my testimony. I'm certainly willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Eastwood, for your testimony this morning, and thank you for the work you're doing on behalf of those teens who need a little help. Questions for Dr. Eastwood before we move on to other testifiers. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for the testifier. Do you have any numbers and facts of the veterans who are have committed suicide, those who are returning from the Gulf Wars, the Iraqi Wars, and particularly the ages of, say, 19 to 25?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I do not have those specific numbers with me today. I can certainly try and track those down. I know that the number of veterans who use our service is relatively low, but that we did expand that service through the NSPL, and if we could take that, which actually moved us from funding of $2,500 to $3,500 per year. It's an ongoing struggle, and we have actually spent a fair amount of time historically working with the Minnesota National Guard to try and increase their rate of usage of our services and to coordinate with them.
Representative McDonald. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for your presentation. It was very compelling. I just wanted to ask you about a statistic that I heard that went by pretty fast, that you said that Native Americans had a suicide rate of, or youth, maybe 30.4%. Could you just clarify, what was that 30.4% that you mentioned?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, the statistics on Native American youth are tragic and very troubling. The statistic is an age-specific rate of 30.7 per 100,000, and that's the highest in the state.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, yeah, that is shocking enough, but I thought you were talking about a percentage. So I just thank you for clarifying that.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at this map here. Can you kind of like explain this map, the color-coded and what that means, and then kind of like describe for us what this last line means?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the map before you, the color-coded areas simply represent a different region for us where we have a regional coordinator. We typically hire someone from the local community or within that region who is known to that community and part of that community, and they then do outreach across that area. In addition, you'll see the light blue noted areas are the different tribal communities. The gray area is the area that is currently not covered by the Text for Life program because we do not have a regional coordinator there.
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So what we have in the areas that are color-coded is one regional individual who is picking up texts for that region?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, I don't think I was very clear about this. Let me clarify. All of the text messaging currently comes into our call center in Richfield where we have our staff located. The color coding and the regional coordinator is an individual who is a public health trained educator who lives and works in that area. And we contract with either the public health agency in that community or the community health center to employ that person. They then are going out and doing educational programs in schools and in the community. They're not the receiver of the text message. They are training children how to use the tool itself. It's really the one time when at a school assembly, all the kids are asked to bring their phones with them. They're taught about Text for Life. They're taught about how to access Text for Life. And they're asked all to put that into their phone, obviously, in order to help if one of their friends needs this service. So they've all got it in their phone. They're ready to go with it. That's the role of the regional coordinators, to do the education, build ties among different community partners and different stakeholders that we have, and bring people together around building the Text for Life program. But they're not actually doing the answering of the text messages themselves.
Okay.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how effective is that? Because these areas, like in the northern east area here, it's a pretty big area for one individual to go out and do an educational presentation. So how effective do you think you currently are with the work that needs to be done regionally?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Those are some very large areas, and it's typically based on a sense of how many school districts and the population in that area. And certainly there's a lot of area to cover, I think we're really quite effective. We've been a lot more effective during the last year and a half or so when we have really been able to bring a more professional approach, I think, to some of the regional coordinators. We've set some very clear standards for them through our work with Department of Human Services on this, to set standards for how many outreach meetings they're doing, how many health fairs they're doing, how many schools they're getting into. And it really is their task. This is their focus, is to be an educator and to be out on the road, meeting with people, getting themselves in front of kids. And I think it's fairly effective.
Okay. Representative Moran.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I had a question. First of all, I just want to say that this is wonderful that we're talking about this. This is an issue that's affected my life, as it is, I'm sure, a number of us in different ways. So I really appreciate it. And I've actually heard about this program in my area, in my district, and so the word is out and people use it. So wonderful. My question is for Dr. Eastwood. So in the bill, it just talks about text message suicide prevention and not specifically the text for life. So could you just speak to, are there other programs, are there other organizations, entities that do similar things in these areas, or is this some, you know, just speak to that piece of this?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there certainly are some other organizations on a national level that do this work. Text for Life is really the predominant program in the state of Minnesota. We do have some other text programs that are smaller and more focused in nature. For example, we work with one suburban police department that uses a text platform that we have for their, I'm going to blank in there, basically for their SWAT team to operate out of their command center, so that like most of us, as we're aging, so apparently are people who are taking others hostage, and they won't respond to the telephone call anymore, but they will respond to a text message. And this particular agency has found it helpful to have that capability in their crisis center, and so they can text or call. So there are some small one-offs to it, but the predominant program we have is the Text for Life program.
Representative Olson. Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Eastwood, I had a question. As clearly we have really stunning rates of suicide in the Native community. And as I look at the map in the gray areas, it appears as though there's 4, maybe 3.5 reservation communities that are not covered currently by Text for Life, where there's not a regional coordinator in those areas. Is that correct?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we've done something a little bit unique there, in that all the tribal communities are covered, in that certainly where we have the colored area, we have a regional coordinator there, but we have also hired more recently two tribal liaisons who work with us to support the work of the regional coordinators, and where there is not currently a regional coordinator, they are connecting and working with those tribal communities.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess to that point, who are these folks? Are they connected to the tribal community? Are they tribal members themselves? Just sort of looking for a little additional information about cultural competency of some of these folks in the program, because I think it's clearly important. But as we're looking at the highest rates of suicide for this community, it's probably critical, in my estimation, that folks have that expertise and those connections.
Dr. Eastwood, sorry.
All right. Mr. Chair and Representative, the individuals that we have hired as tribal liaisons are members of the tribal nations, members of those communities. In addition, we have brought training into all the staff in the tech center and the call center to train them to be more culturally competent to work with Native communities. It was really a shortcoming and something that we lacked. And I'll be honest that we made a lot of mistakes when we originally began working with the tribal communities. They have been very gracious and willing to overlook those and then to join with us and partner with us and to help that work move forward. And so we as an agency and as an organization are much more skilled today than we were even a year and a half ago. But we see the need to work with people who know those communities, understand those cultures, work with them, and want to partner with us to do that work.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question has to deal with data privacy, and I'm just wondering how long those texts are on file for, if they get destroyed after a certain period of time. Is there any worries that an individual who reaches out in a moment of distress has to worry about those text messages showing up later in life?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is a piece of information I do not personally hold. If you'd like, I could bring the manager of the crisis connection forward to answer the more fine-grained detail.
You want? Mr. Chair.
Representative Franzen.
And to the author, is this anything that you're aware of or about the messages? They get destroyed, how long they're kept on file for?
No, but we can bring someone forward that can talk to that for you.
Representative Fenton, is this another someone who's already going to be testifying?
No.
Okay. Then welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and help us with this question.
Hello. My name is Laura Weber. I am the manager of Crisis Connection. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. When someone texts in, they clearly have the text messages on their telephone. That is handled by their carrier. And so when the texts are deleted off of your phone, your carrier has access to them. Kind of, it's been described to me as a big pool. It's a big bucket of texts that would take a while to individually pull messages out. But in reality, they are capable of getting our text messages out of their, let's say, you know, whatever your carrier is, their pool. In terms of our platform, our platform doesn't store text messages in a way that we could pull them back out. It's merely a vehicle for us to communicate back and forth. The text conversations then are recorded in an electronic record system in a one record format where there's some specific information, phone number, time of start, time of stop, things like that, and then a basic description of what happened. And that is stored in an electronic record system by the phone number. We don't have a elimination date on that, but we can certainly, at any time that we desire it, say after 7 years, these are deleted in the system. What we do in the case of a conversation of text messaging, we alert the texter during the message and at the end of the message that this is on your phone. It's not confidential because it's on your phone. And if you want it off your phone, please delete it for your own privacy. So that's how we handle that part of it on their side. On our side, we handle it according to HIPAA guidelines like everything else in the behavioral health care world.
Representative Franzen. All right, thank you for that. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in putting it in the Department of Human Services as opposed to the Department of Health. So the health equity leadership that the Department of Health has undertaken, and they have various grants that that are granted to communities that directly serve populations that are, you're talking about tribal communities, reservations, urban areas, rural communities. Do you have similar to what Representative Fine was asking, the cultural competency and those relationships that the Department of Health has formed with tribal with nonprofits serving tribal communities? Because it's my understanding that some of them are doing this type of using texting, because I believe the CDC provides some funding to some organizations that serve tribal communities and urban areas. And so I'm wondering if you have the same sort of people in place in the Department of Human Services that are similar to the individuals that are running the health equity programs in the Department of Health.
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative, to be honest with you, I'm not familiar with those individuals, so I can't really speak to that. I can say that We are working with and communication with Department of Health as well as Department of Human Services on the work that we're doing, so they're certainly familiar with us, but I can't speak to the skills or some other grant funding. Our funding for textual ed comes through the Department of Human Services currently.
Representative Allen.
Thank you. Even with the Department of Health, given their efforts to develop the cultural competency, there was still issues with, I think it was a $3 to $5 million that was available for grants to address health disparities, racial health disparities. And it was often that a lot of more work needed to be done, technical assistance needed to be provided to some of the organizations so that they could be competitive in receiving the grants or applying for the grants. And so I think a lot of work needs to be done at that level, and I think the Department of Health is trying to reevaluate how that grant-making process works and so it can get to those organizations that have the relationships with the people they serve to develop that competency.
Any follow-up to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's something I know that the Canvas Health is in constant communication with Department of Health, Department of Human Services, and that's something that we can look at and work together on in the future as this progresses down the road. So thank you, Representative Allen.
All right. Any further questions for Dr. Eastwood? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question for Dr. Eastwood, or maybe Representative Fenton. According to a Pew Research, 63% of teens prefer texting. Now, that's 2011. As you know, it's 2017. I don't know about your teens, but my teens Snapchat all the time in their instant messaging as 22% of 2011. I would think those numbers would be flipped as of today. Is there any thought, or is it any thought, or do you think it would be a good idea to perhaps look into that, or perhaps they have, into instant messaging in addition to text messaging for this suicide prevention program?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's a wonderful idea. We're constantly looking at what technology is available, but also what we can afford to implement. Certainly as different tools become available to us, whether it's FaceTiming with voice, or instant messaging, or Snapchat, or the other 100 things that are out there today. We'll certainly continue to look at that and move the technology forward with the tools that kids are using. But at this point, it seems like text messaging is still pretty high on that list. I think there's a lot of instant messaging between kids because they want it there and gone, and text messaging seems to be pretty effective at this point. Much more effective, honestly, than voice. Historically, Crisis Connection would get about 150 phone calls a year from teenagers. Very shortly into the Text for Life program, we're at 11,000. It's certainly tapped into where kids live and how kids communicate today, but we'll certainly continue to look at new technologies as they come along and implement them when we can.
All right. Any other final questions for Dr. Eastwood? Seeing none, Dr. Eastwood, the committee thanks you for your time this morning and for your work on this project. Next, we have Ms. Mulvihill to testify on the bill. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Shannon Mulvihill, Executive Director of Mental Health Minnesota and co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. I'm also a former Crisis Connection volunteer. First, I'd like to express the network's support for the proposed bill to provide funding for Crisis Connection and Text for Life. The network has long recognized the importance of building a comprehensive mental health system in our state that meets the needs of people living with mental illness. Access to crisis services is a key part of meeting that need. The suicide rate in Minnesota hit a record high in 2015. Services like Crisis Connection and Text for Life help people across Minnesota who are struggling. They offer more of an upstream level of service that's a crucial part of the continuum of mental health services across our state. I know because I've been a part of the work in the past. I completed my master's degree in counseling in 2008 and did my clinical work at Crisis Connection. That means I logged more than 700 hours at Crisis Connection and took hundreds of calls during a 9-month period. calls at 2 in the afternoon, calls at 3 in the morning, calls from people who are struggling with difficult symptoms from their illness, isolation, and suicidal thoughts. I wanted to share one story that has always stuck with me. One afternoon, I took a call from a young man who said he wanted to end his life. He was calling from his cell phone and standing on the lift bridge in Duluth. I spent more than an hour on the phone with him, eventually able to get emergency personnel out to him to help give him the help that he needed. As the police officer approached him after that hour or so, he cried and thanked me for my help. I've gone to Duluth on vacation every year for a lot of years, but I've never looked at that bridge the same. I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't answered that call, but I'm really grateful that I did. I'm really glad that there's a place for people to call when they need it. Thank you for the opportunity to express the network support. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mulvihill, for your testimony this morning. Questions for Ms. Mulvihill? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Finally, on the list today, we have Mr. Watson. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, committee members and chairman. My name is Wade Watson. I'm a critical care paramedic for Lakeview Hospital out of Stillwater, Minnesota. I was asked today to come maybe speak on a professional basis and a personal basis. We've been affected in the world of EMS with a fellow paramedic committing suicide approximately 4 years ago, a firefighter that we worked closely with 3 years ago, a police officer 2 years ago. It affects our profession quite a bit. We tend to think that we are the people who come help you, and we often forget to ask for help ourselves. We tend to see a lot of accidents and incidences that affect us on a pretty deep level, and we internally try to bury them, I would say, sometimes without a lot of success. Techs for Life, we got associated with Canvas Health probably 4 or 5 years ago in a fundraising effort to gain attention to suicide and suicide awareness after that fellow coworker and friend committed suicide. We wanted to support a local organization in a fundraising effort, and Canvas Health was a perfect match for us. Ever since, they've done everything to show us kind of the internal level. I'm not sure how familiar you are, many of you are, I guess, with just the 911 system. When somebody truly has a problem, 911 is activated, we get out there on scene. Often this person might go down to the emergency room or a care facility for 2 or 3 hours of an evaluation by a doctor and get told to maybe seek some help later. That truly doesn't, I think, solve the problem, especially if it's an acute suicide or mental health crisis that that could be maybe a potential suicide or a potential life threat. This program in Text for Life, I think, offers an opportunity to these people where it's a little bit more confidential. It's a specific person on the other end of the line who's dealt with this situation. And I think they offer something that our service as a paramedic, 911, emergency room facilities just don't understand. I would assume that many of you are seeing both via the news and maybe personal life, the problems with mental health are just dramatically increasing. The last couple of years, our call volumes for mental health crisis, suicide, are just astronomically growing. So my job today was here, I don't know, probably just to help give some insight on that level, and I'm happy to offer some insight on where I see this problem and the benefit of Text for Life. It's a great program that I think can help a lot of people in that moment of panic and moment of, problem.
Thank you, Mr. Watson, for your testimony and for the perspective that you bring to this as well here. Are there any questions for Mr. Watson? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the testifier, you referring to the rate of increase of calls that you're getting, and I'm wondering if you have anything to share with us about why the rate is increasing.
Mr. Watson. So just in my service alone, we offer three ambulances basically at 24 hours a day in Washington County. We're based out of Stillwater, Minnesota. We cover anywhere from western Wisconsin over in Somerset and Richmond area all the way to North St. Paul, down to 94, almost to Woodbury, and up to Marina on St. Croix, Scandia. Our volume in the last 3 years has gone from about 4,000 911 calls to this year we're over 7,000. I guess my idea of behind it, one of the things is population. I think our population in the last couple of years has grown, but also the social economics, the economy and the stress I think that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years has probably added to a lot more mental health based calls on the 911 service. I don't know exactly specifics, but that's probably one of the bigger ones. I think it's okay maybe to talk about it. There's a generational gap where my parents, even maybe myself, as opposed to the 20-year-olds, that technology aspect of texting for help, that wasn't even considered back in my day, my parents' day, whatever. And I think that's an outlet now or an opportunity to at least use your voice, use your text, use your ability to ask for help.
Thank you. Representative Murphy. Any other questions for Mr. Watson? All right, seeing none, Mr. Watson, thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you, guys.
Mr. Chair, I also have a member from a tribal member, Lori Nelson, here to testify.
All right, Ms. Nelson, if you could make your way down to the testifier table. And if you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, committee. My name is Lori Nelson. I'm from the Lorsu Indian community. I hold a position of chemical dependency worker, and I was asked to testify on behalf of Text for Life. I have two letters here, one from Chairman Jensvold at Upper Sioux Community supporting this, and one from our tribal president, Robert Larson, supporting this as well. I just want to talk a little bit about my experience as a community member and as a person who has dealt with a lot of our children and their pain. Growing up, you know, on the reservation, one of our youngest people was 12 years old. Our president has stated that we've had a flurry of deaths of our young people to drug overdose and suicide. And like I said, our youngest one was 12 years old. Text for Life, I believe, is very important as far as our kids these days, that's the way they communicate. And whatever kind of tools or avenues that helps them communicate their pain and to reach out would be beneficial to saving our children. Text for Life is funded by DHS, and it's been successful there, and it makes sense to stay there. And the approach through the Department of Human Services, Text for Life, takes in partnering with tribal nations. It's effective and culturally responsive. It's competent. Text for Life helps programs take direction from tribes themselves, what is best as determined by each tribal nation. I'm also the the chairwoman for the Parent Advisory Committee for our Indian Ed Department for Redwood Valley School System. And we're trying to address these kind of things. Like I said, we've lost quite a few people, young people, 12 being the youngest, and three brothers that we've lost in our community. Whatever kind of tools that we can help to have our children stay with us is very important as a tribal nation. So on behalf of one of the 11 Minnesota reservations, we would like to know that we support Text for Life. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Nelson, thank you for your testimony this morning and the perspective that you bring to this program. Questions for Ms. Nelson, Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if it's directly to this testifier, but just a general question to the bill author. And that is, having my own kids that text and all that, I know sometimes they'll get each other's phones and they'll send texts. What happens in the case where someone sends a text in a jokingly manner that could be misconstrued in the wrong way?
Representative Fenton.
Thank you. I think I will allow Dr. Eastwood to answer that as they deal with they take in the text messages on a daily basis.
All right. Dr. Eastwood, if you'd like to come down, and Ms. Nelson, if you can stay close, because I think we do have a few questions for you, too.
Eastwood.
I apologize. We're swapping out. The technical piece of the service is that both call and text, our goal and our duty through our accreditation and best practices, that we respond in a least restrictive manner. So that also means on the other end of it that we take every text and call seriously. We do note that we get some pranks, both on call and text. Teenagers will do these things every now and again. And so if we get a text message or a phone call where someone is stating they're suicidal or there's an intent to harm themselves or someone else, we think there's imminent risk involved. We will then ask for emergency services to respond to the home. There are times when, let's say, a sheriff's officer will present at the home and find that the child was watching TV with the parent or whatever and they were just messing around. That's an opportunity to say, this isn't messing around, this is serious. You told us you were intending to kill yourself. We will get a response to you if at all possible. So pranking is one thing, but we don't know on a call or a text if it is a joke. So we are going to respond every time that we can.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So the testifier, so in the, do you have the percentage of those? How many are actually false positives like that? And also, it sounds like if you do that, services will be engaged and somebody's going to pay for that. Does that then get billed to the parents?
Ms. Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't know what happens on the back end of that. All I know is we have an imminent situation. We are asking for a response. How it's taken care of on the other side, I don't know. Sometimes, not a lot in those situations, but sometimes the officer will call us back and say, this is what happened. And that's good for us to know. However, what I tell my staff is, okay, this one was a prank. You don't know about the next one. We're going to respond every time.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, I think my question is for maybe Dr. Eastwood, maybe. So I was just looking at the map again, and I'm not quite sure what the little blue dots are, but looking at the 7 Metro County area, urban, I don't see much engagement there. So as part of your expansion, well, I guess one, why is it not any support in the 7 Metro County areas, and what is your expectation moving forward?
Dr. Eastwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. We're not currently in the metro area. The program started in northeastern Minnesota and has spread around the state. With the resources we had and the our ability to respond to those text messages, we moved into areas that both asked for the services, wanted the services, and where we thought we could handle the volume coming from there. I will say that we respond to text messages from every county in the state of Minnesota currently. The difference being we simply do not yet have, if you will, boots on the ground in Hennepin County and Ramsey County with regional coordinators who are going out to the schools and doing the educational pieces. Once the information is out, which it is, of course, on the Internet, and you can find it very easily, you start receiving text messages. So we do respond to people in the metro area. We simply do not yet have the regional coordinators in those areas. And part of the reason for that, in all honesty, is this is a very new technology and it's growing. And we were a bit concerned that if we went right straight to the metro, where a large portion of the state of Minnesota resides, that we would be overwhelmed in the text center and unable to actually respond to all of the text inquiries that we had. We didn't think it was going to be very helpful if we got overwhelmed before we really got off the ground and got started. We would expect with this expansion that we would cover and have regional coordinators in all parts of the state covering the entire state and responding to all the text messages we might receive.
Representative
Moran. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any further questions for any of the testifiers we've had so far? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 501? Seeing none, are there any final questions from members for the bill author? Seeing none, I will officially call the meeting to order. And then I will move that House File 501 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted, and House File 501 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Fenton, and the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For your presentation this morning. Next, we will bring up House File 237, Representative Dean. And while Representative Dean is getting ready, Representative McDonald moves adoption of the minutes from January 26. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from January 26, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes from January 26 are adopted. Representative Dean, welcome to the committee. Do you wish to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 237 and then immediately move the Delete All Amendment.
All right. Representative Dean moves that House File 237 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. And Representative Dean moves the DE1 Amendment. Representative Dean, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill relates to some of the work that we have done around coordinated care, specifically with North, but not exclusively with North, trying to get at providing better care, more coordinated care for people who need lots of help that we have had in the past through our GAMC program and the CCDS program that came out of that. Started down the road a little bit towards towards coordinated care. We also have competitive coordinated programs currently within our public programs in the state. And what this is doing is it's trying to look at six additional tests to try to coordinate some care, to try to provide a little bit of money on top of what we are currently doing and paying for. In order to provide more coordinated care. North was one of these hospital systems that stepped forward in 2010 and 11 to provide coordinated care for people who have very complex needs, for single adults without children at that time who had high incidences of hypertension, diabetes, persistent mental illness, chemical dependency, that were very expensive to take care of and required a lot more coordination than was being provided. And what we're trying to do is to look at what's next, to try to get down total cost of care within, particularly within our Medicaid population, but not exclusively, that we can provide better care at lower cost if we have more coordination. Today we have Jason Rusinek from North Memorial, who's been looking at this. He's the Director of Contracting and Medicaid and Medicare Services, to really look at where we might be headed next within this. I think it's an area where we're going to be paying for value and we're going to be paying for coordination. And particularly if you look at our Medicaid spend and our hospital spend, we're going to need to really get a handle on cost. I think this is one of the ways that we can do that. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I just want to introduce Mr. Rusinek for North.
Mr. Rusinek, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present us with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jason Rusinek. I am the Director of Population Management at North Memorial Accountable Care, and then also interim for Contracting and Managed Care Services. I will keep my comments brief, but wanted to provide a little bit of context for the reason that we are continuing to pursue this, and would be happy to answer any questions that you have after that. Just for context, North Memorial, in addition to being a part of the CCDS program back in 2010-2011, we were also one of the first participants in what was then the HCDS program, which became IHP. We started our participation in that program in 2013. Currently, or as of the last year in 2016, we had just over 30,000 Medicaid members who were attributed to our IHP program. The providers who provide services for our version of the IHP or our IHP include not only North Memorial providers, but we also work with a number of independent primary care practices throughout the state of Minnesota, including some what we would call high quality, low cost providers. This is just a sampling of that core group you can see on the PowerPoint there, including the Broadway Family Medicine Clinic in North Minneapolis, MultiCare Associates in the North Suburbs, North Clinic serving the North and Northwest Suburbs, North Memorial Healthcare, Northwest Family Physicians, and Stellus Health, formerly Buffalo Clinic, up in Buffalo, Monticello, and St. Michael, Albertville. We have successfully achieved savings in 2013, 2014, and 2015, saving the state money and also earning the incentive payments during that time. Our results for 2016 are still pending. We should find those out later this year. This map just gives you an idea of where the membership for our IHP come from throughout the state. As you can see, we have pockets of darker green signify more membership, lighter green, and then going to gray is where there's less membership, but we still do draw from quite a footprint throughout the state. And you can see that we have rather diverse, large footprint stretching, again, from the Twin Cities metro area all the way up through the I-94 corridor. Because of our participation in the IHP program, we've been able to do and pursue a number of things. One of them that I'm sure that this group is familiar with has been the community paramedic program. It's been a crucial part of care management for some of our highest risk individuals in our population. We have supported work specifically around care transitions, so leaving the hospital, going back into the community, with a focus on avoiding readmission, avoiding additional utilization of healthcare services, and really trying to reestablish care in the appropriate settings, including primary care. We have also focused work in chronic disease management. We have done some very specific programming. One that they always like us to highlight is work that we have done with pediatric asthma, so identifying members within our population who are at risk or newly diagnosed with asthma, and working with families in a way to help manage pediatric asthma, again, in the home without having to use high-cost sites of care like the emergency department. And finally, this program has also been very instrumental in the amount of community engagement we've been able to pursue. As we'll talk about in just a moment, the relationships we've developed with community-based resources, non-traditional healthcare delivery resources, a lot of that has been facilitated by or resourced by our community paramedic program. Some of the examples of that, we have developed partnerships with a number of community-based organizations. This is just a sampling of some of the work that we have done. Portico HealthNet is working with us to support continuous enrollment of individuals. One of the problems we face in this program is that as people drop off of enrollment or forget to renew their insurance, we lose sight of them. We lose the line of sight. We lose visibility into their utilization or their activity. We are also working with Vail Place. They have a pretty innovative clubhouse model where we provide resource as an extension of primary care in their clubhouses. They also support work within our facilities and our mental health clinic with their specialized case management resources supporting patients. So we've integrated across sites with Vail Place. With Turning Point, we have provided additional resource to extend primary care into their facility. We've worked with the Minnesota Department of Health both on education programs and also on some health screenings in the community. And then a number of other organizations, the YMCA, Second Harvest Heartland, North Market, being developed with Pillsbury United Communities and various public schools where we are moving our resources into the community to meet members and patients where they are. Some of the challenges or also opportunities and some of the reason that we have, again, we support this legislation. Some of the issues that we face within the current IHP program are not inconsistent with challenges we face within the federal Medicare Shared Savings Program as well, but membership churn. So retrospective attribution models, models that give us responsibility for patients after an event has already occurred, present problems, including being able to completely track member activity and cost. There are any number of reasons why members can come on and off of our rolls, which provides difficulty as we're trying to manage and support their health. And then also recognition within the financial model. As there is churn, as people do come on and off of our rolls, the way that the incentive payments work tend to take a look at who's attributed to you at the end of a performance period, which doesn't always capture the body of work or the amount, the number of individuals who we have applied resource to during that time period. Second is the timeliness of the incentive payments. So the way that the IHP program is structured, there is a run out after a performance period. There's a reconciliation process, and it is a lengthy time, sometimes greater than 9 months, close to a year before payment is realized for a performance period. And that also poses challenges in that many of the services that we're providing or the new resources that we're applying in the management of this population are not traditionally captured in the fee-for-service model. So we're not receiving payments throughout the year as we're applying this resource, these resources to patients and individuals. And it may not be completely appropriate to include those in the fee-for-service model. And it also limits our ability to scale. So we went from, in 2015, having roughly 5,000 members in our IHP. We added a number of clinics. That number grew to where it is today, at just over 30,000 members. But it's been difficult to scale the resources necessary to support both that geographic footprint that I showed and the number of individuals and the diversity within the communities we serve. Waiting for payment to come after a performance period. DHS and the IHP program have been great about partnering, working together in a number of different areas, providing flexibility within these programs. However, the basic economics of the payment model have not evolved with the same pace that some of the other features of the program are. And that's what we would like to advocate for today, is just being able to continue to experiment and pilot with different elements of the economic model to continue to support this work. And with that, I can take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Resenac, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for Mr. Resenac, Representative Liebling?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I think that probably most members, at least those who've been around and have heard about some of these things before, you know, I think most of us are big believers in coordinated care as a way to address especially some of our higher cost folks and give them better care as well as deal with the cost. So, you know, certainly I think we're all behind that effort. But I'm just a little bit confused about what's being proposed here, and maybe it's just me, but I hope you'll just indulge me a little bit. So, first of all, I'm a little bit confused about how this intersects with our current PMAP program. So I'm assuming that some of the people that will be enrolled in these pilots or are enrolled in the current one are people who are on our Medicaid program and enrolled in through one of the HMOs, so that we're paying a capitated rate for those people. So how does that work with what you're proposing here? Does the HMO then make a payment, an additional payment, or, you know, how does the money flow through that system? Maybe I'm missing something completely here, but something isn't clicking for me in how this all would work.
Mr. Resnick?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that what we're pursuing is the opportunity to explore how that would work. Currently, under today's IHP, you're correct, the PMAP membership is included in that, and there are not always the what we would call care management or those per member per month payments flowing through to providers from the managed care organizations. So it is correct, if there's a capitated rate being paid to the managed care organizations, but most of what is being paid through to providers is through that traditional fee-for-service model.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, okay, so if we're paying through the capitation, how are we also paying for through fee-for-service? I know maybe we should ask DHS to come down and comment on some of this and see if they could explain it a little better. I don't know if they are supportive of this or, well, I mean, maybe you could just take another shot at that. They can't be both, right? They're either fee-for-service and the state is paying through fee-for-service, you know, getting a bill in and paying it for whatever that service was, or we're paying a capitated rate to an HMO, which is then supposed to deal with all the payments to providers. So it can't be both for the same person, right?
Mr. Resnick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. I will take another stab at explaining that. We have agreements as the healthcare providers with the MCOs, and those agreements are based on traditional fee-for-service models. So they are paying us for claims that we submit. We don't have necessarily the exposure to any sort of care management payment beyond healthcare home payments in our relationships with managed care organizations. That's what I was referring to.
Okay.
Chair Dean. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, this bill looks at six different pilots, North being one of six, and it's $12 per person per month in the network. So in North's case, they have, 36,000, I think you said, folks?
30,000 through the attribution model, about 34,000 in our internal system.
Yeah, so a little over 30,000 people total. Of that, you have to look at the people who would qualify for this would be people with multiple chronic problems, and then within that group, people who volunteer. And so it's an extra level of coordination with a small fee per month. That's what really kind of we're looking at. And it anticipates things down the road changing, I think you'd have to say. So there's individually within the programs that currently have members and get paid for through the different structures that we currently have. This is another model that looks at coordination that anticipates that we might be doing things differently down the road and sets that ball rolling. But it's just six programs, $12 per person per month within the existing lanes of payment.
Representative Wavelin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Demo. So I guess then the question is, who pays the $12? So are we...
DHS.
Okay, so in other words, we're paying a capitated rate to the health plans. We, for these people, and I get your point that you're talking about a relatively small number of people, although they're the high-cost people. But presumably the $12 a month helps us to reduce costs, improve care for that small group of people. But then if they're on PMAP, the savings presumably goes to the health plans, because most people are on one of those plans. Very few people get fee-for-service anymore. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about an additional payment from the state to the providers to provide better care so that the health plans can save some money. Now, I get what you're talking about, that if we find out this is a wonderful idea, we could expand it and maybe, I don't know, maybe build in the savings and reduce rates to the health plans. I'm sure that that's kind of the idea long term, but I don't understand why, if this is a great idea, why the health plans themselves wouldn't be willing to pay the extra $12 and reduce their own costs, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
Sure.
Representative Liebling, and I think that's a fair point to look at who has skin in the game and where the savings flow back to. But in North's case, I think they've been very good and proactive about raising their hand and stepping forward with innovative programs to try to coordinate care. Some of their costs get covered and some of them don't. And they understand, I think you saw within the presentation, that they're losing money in certain areas of trying to coordinate. And because our payment models don't recognize the good things that they're doing to lower costs, we're trying to align those incentives, and be certainly willing to work with you and other members of this committee or the Finance Committee for ways to improve that as we move forward.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel like we're in a new episode of Back to the Future, and our chair is Dr. Brown with your time machine, which you would understand. Maybe not everybody else will understand, but I think you do understand. When we tried this before, I think the biggest problems with the CCDS were distribution of people and the amount of money that was in that idea. The idea was a good one, but the implementation was rough. So I am interested in this. I'm interested in working with you. I think Representative Liebling brings up really good points about the difficulty of aligning incentives in the environment in which we are contracting. And I think that's something that we should push ourselves to figure out, so that if there are savings, they are aligned in the place, and I think it is with the providers who are creating those savings with super sick people. In the Delete All Amendment, you talk about individuals who are eligible. One of the things I think we need to pay attention to here is line 1.17, when we talk about someone who resides in a service area. And we know from our experience that a lot of the people that would be eligible for something like this are highly mobile and sometimes don't have a residence at all, which makes it hard then to attribute them to a residence area or a care service area. So I'm wondering if, Mr. Resnick, if you've thought that part through in your experience working on this at North Memorial, how you're dealing with highly mobile or homeless potential enrollees.
Mr. Resnick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. Yes, we have. That's one of the examples of a group of individuals who are very high resource. When we are having to go out into the community to try and track them down, keep them engaged with primary care services, it is a challenge. It's one of those challenges that's very time-consuming, again, very resource-heavy, and doesn't always get either compensated for or accounted for through the current models. As far as the assignments or the mobility of that population, again, when we look at that, there are people who are moving in and out of the area frequently, and it's a challenge within the retrospective attribution model to know who we are either accountable for, responsible for. It's something we would like to pursue and continue to work with DHS on to figure out a model that would better account for that level of activity and that level of support.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up on that. If there's someone in your network, if you will, who is highly mobile and they leave the area, are they then disqualified from continued participation? Say they move into the next door area, right? They're in Hennepin County, but in the HCMC area instead of the North Memorial area. Would they then be disqualified and fall out of your out of the relational network that has been built with care providers?
Mr. Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I under the current model, that is what occurs and partly what's incented. Our goal would be to figure out an equitable or appropriate way of managing those types of scenarios.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I just have one comment. I think that Representative Dean did a little foreshadowing for us about where we're headed and why this might be important. And, you know, there are all sorts of efforts underway, I think, outside of our purview with health systems in terms of care coordination, because many believe the value and people do get better care. But one of the scenarios under which this could be necessary is if and when the Congress decides to block grant Medicaid and people currently covered under medical assistance would no longer be covered under medical assistance, and then this would be maybe a mechanism to try and keep people in care who don't have coverage. And that was the situation that we experienced back in 2010. Representative Dean and I worked on that as well. And while this model is a good model, it was pretty inadequate for that really sick group of people. So I appreciate the jumpstart that we're getting on what may be a really difficult situation for Minnesota for our budget and for people who are pretty sick. I think we should keep both those scenarios in mind, people in coverage and people outside of coverage, as we consider this pilot. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at the last paragraph or page 3.19, page 3, it says to improve outcomes and reduce the total cost of care for specific high groups of patients enrolled in Minnesota Care and other programs. Representative Dean, this is a great program and a great bill. And I say that because I have experience with the Federal Qualified Healthcare Centers, the FQHCs, in which I was able to help and work with them for many years. But since 2013, because they coordinated care, their ER use has been down 28%, and they've saved over $18 million in ER admissions because of the coordinated care. Just yesterday, I was talking to my doctor, Dr. Scott Jensen, now Senator Jensen from Carver County, and working with him to really find some good health care reforms. You know, last week we passed some health care reforms really that addressed health premiums and some minor reforms, but really if we want to get to the gist of it, we need to coordinate care. So he's working on some legislation over on the Senate side of coordinated care between the doctor and the patient. That is one of the single most important factors that we can reduce the cost of the care and really help the people that need the help. And I just asked a question for Mr. Ruzanek, that have you considered what others have done, such as the FQHCs, and model your pilot program after them? There's no reason to spend any money on reinventing the wheel when it's proven since 2013 that there's success in coordinating that care. So have you considered that for modeling your pilot program? And then also you mentioned something about a hospital, was it Albertville or St. Michael or Buffalo? near my area of Wright County, so kind of a two questions at this point.
Mr. Resnick.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, the first part of that question, we certainly have worked closely with and worked collaboratively with the FQHCs in our area and learned from the successful elements of their care model, the things that they are doing differently to engage their population of patients. Although it has changed in recent years, FQHCs have traditionally had different funding sources than organizations like North Memorial have had, which have supported some of that work, recognizing the amount of uncompensated care that they provide, recognizing the populations that they serve. And so while there are certainly elements that we would like to learn from and model our care model redesign work off of, again, the underlying economics of that continue to present challenges. And then the second part of your question, I'm sorry, I don't know. We do have relationships with the clinics, Stellus Health, up in Buffalo, Albertville, St. Michael area, and then also Monticello, and are working to expand just what points of access we have with those providers in those communities. They're participants in both our Medicaid IHP program and also alongside with us in our Medicare Shared Savings Program.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just in closing, the FQHCs have a population of around 33,000 people, so and they have great success. I personally think, and I've heard from many doctors and those in the healthcare profession, that this is the single most important issue in bringing the cost of healthcare down and getting to treat those people that we prioritize. So I encourage everybody to pause and take notice that through Representative Dean's bill and others hopefully coming down the pike, that's the only way that we will ever be able to get our handle on healthcare and cure and help those who are in most need. So, Representative Dean, thank you for your good work, and you'll see some bills of mine as well that will help coordinate care and fix and hopefully our health care system.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Chair. My question goes specifically to line 1.6 of the amendment, where it states basically the establishment of these pilot programs would be to test alternative and innovative integrated health care delivery networks. As a teacher, I always wonder what your interpretation of alternative and innovative means. So practical application, what would that look like compared to a traditional delivery model?
Mr. Resnick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the types of integrated healthcare delivery networks start to pursue partnerships with, again, those community-based resources that address more of the social need or the social determinants of health that a traditional healthcare delivery system or medical model don't necessarily address or aren't equipped to address. So, for example, we recognize that food insecurity and nutrition are significant drivers of health and utilization and expense associated with healthcare. And so instead of North Memorial pursuing or trying to hire or provide or redevelop the resources that already exist in the community, we are trying to integrate with and establish relationships with those types of organizations that are providing those services within the community or working to address those needs within the community, and figuring out a way to both integrate our systems so that information can be shared, but also make sure that we are working with those entities in a coordinated management of the needs of the patients that we serve.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Excuse me, Representative Sandstead, if I could jump back in.
Sure.
Where was that you had said that was?
1.6.
1.6.
Current law.
Representative Sandstead, I want to apologize. Those are kind of garbagey words that I usually strike out of stuff when I see it. So I'll try to be more specific in the future and less gobbledygooky. Sorry.
Thank
Representative
you.
Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so as I'm looking at the language of the bill on page 2, so one of the things that this bill would do, starting on line 2.25, what this bill is doing is exempting these pilot projects from certain standards that are already in place for the IHPs, or the integrated health networks that are already exist. So one of the things, for example, it says that these new pilot programs would be exempted from certain standards, standardized quality of care and patient satisfaction standards for IHPs must be waived, changed, or risk adjusted based on the economic, behavioral health, cultural, and geographic risk factors of the patient served. And then similarly on page 3, we've got a waiver of the requirements for the minimum number of people to be eligible for an IHP, and it also says that the commissioner, this is on 3.5, the commissioner shall waive or modify IHP requirements that may discourage participation by rural, independent, community-based, and safety net providers. So I guess I'm looking for a little more specificity about what those things are, because what the bill is doing is, I guess, allowing what some would say would be more flexibility, and what others might say would be standards that have to be met. And I guess I'm wondering what, you know, the language is pretty broad and, you know, might be appropriate, might be necessary, but I'm wondering what you have in mind there that would be, you would be exempted from, or that these pilot projects would be exempted from, that's getting in the way providing the kind of care that the folks would need, or that might, you know, improve care and save money, if that's, those are the goals. So can you be a little more specific about what these exemptions are, might exempt people from?
Mr. Resnick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know through some of the conversations that we've had with other IHPs and providers who would like to participate in the IHP that there are a number of different concerns that they have, whether it is the minimum amount of enrollment or certain types of standards. I can't speak specifically to how, again, it would be practically implemented. Again, the goal would be for what you commented on, the flexibility to work with DHS on recognizing that there are different needs excuse me, within different communities, and that there are also different levels of risk within the populations that we serve, that it's not uniform, it's not standard across the populations that we serve. So it's, again, looking for that flexibility.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, because what as I'm understanding this, what these pilot programs are doing, these are, we already have the integrated health partnerships, which are an attempt to really move toward coordinated care and share the savings with providers, give incentives to coordinate care. We already have medical homes or healthcare homes that give an extra payment for coordination of care. And then, if please correct me if I'm wrong, but what this is doing is having an additional pilot program that keeps those payments and adds this additional payment on top of that to do something more. And I'm just not sure what the more is, and also to allow these providers to do, apparently, something, to not do something they're already required to do in these other programs. And I guess that I'm not opposed to this in principle, but as it moves forward, I really would like to have some more specifics before we go forward with this, so that we know exactly what it is. After all, if there are some requirements that are preventing IHPs from being successful, or that are preventing healthcare homes from being successful, things that we're already paying for, as a, that the state is already paying additional money for, things that are, you know, things that are regulations that are preventing success in those programs, I think we'd all like to know what those are, because then maybe we want to adjust those for everybody. So, you know, as this moves forward to the Finance Committee, I would really ask you to give us some more specifics about what these pilot programs are looking to do that they can't do now.
Any response to that?
No, we'll be happy to provide more specifics or detail as it moves forward.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Resnick? Representative Moran.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I can agree that we all want to invest in coordinated care. And, you know, after listening and looking at the population that we find often is a challenged population, which is that they're transit, they're homeless, and we're paying a fee of $4 per month for them to be a part of your pilot program. And I would think some of the challenge would be is to coordinate the population. And one of the things that you did state that it was difficult to scale the resources and find the best way to do that, but yet you're willing to expand it to experiment more, right? And so what do you need? What do you think needs to happen to for a population like this that is really hard to scale and to coordinate, mm-hmm. but yet we want to invest additional dollars into something that is difficult to do? What would that look like?
Mr. Resnick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think at the highest level what we would like to be able to do is have a model that recognizes the ongoing effort or ongoing work that is required for that coordination of care. Having payments, whether it's a model similarly to the next gen ACO model that the that CMS has put forth for the Medicare population, where there are per member per month payments made in recognition of the care management activities that go on, regardless of particular health or documented risk factors, just recognition that there are activities that are going on that are resource intensive and cost money. One of the biggest barriers is outside of what we get paid for fee-for-service for, and sorry, I'm using fee-for-service as just the submitting a claim for a service that's provided and then getting paid for the service that's provided, whether it's through an MCO or directly from the state. There aren't efficient ways of getting paid or getting financial recognition for the care management work that's going on. Earlier it was mentioned that there's healthcare home payments. Those are not the easiest payments to both bill for and or receive. And so it's looking to streamline and receive recognition through the form of payment for the care management work that's going on. And just to add on to that, the types of support services that those or types of services that those payments would be supporting, we need flexibility in recognition that the challenges that make one individual high risk are going to be different than some of the challenges that others. It may require more medical attention, more clinical attention. It may require more social service support. It may require support from community-based resources. It may be from a community health worker or a layperson who's helping somebody navigate the system. But again, we're looking for flexibility in accounting for and being able to develop those resources within this model.
And the honor of the final question for Mr. Rusinak is Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one follow-up. So we're creating a per-member, per-month payment for those eligible. I want to know what would happen to the payment method or the goal if those that are currently eligible were no longer covered in medical assistance or Minnesota Care.
Mr. Rusinak.
What would happen then to the model?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a challenge that we face today. People going on and off of different insurance programs, different coverages, employer-based insurance to government programs. It's a problem that we'll continue to address and continue to look for solutions for, but I'm afraid I don't have an easy answer for that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, according to the pilot, if they're not covered for Minnesota Care or medical assistance, they wouldn't be eligible for this, but they would still be in your service area. And there's a potential, right, with the idea of a block grant, that there could be great big numbers of people that are currently covered under those programs that would no longer be covered. Would you still be obligated to them in some way under this model if they were, if, for instance, in medical assistance and then they were no longer covered in medical assistance?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Westenack.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we are always obligated to provide care for those who are seeking care from our organizations. And again, I would say that we are applying resource to individuals who may at one time attribute to us and then fall off of our rolls today. And this is an attempt at trying to get more parity with that, but that will be an issue that we continue to deal with. But we continue to provide services for individuals who need them. Regardless of ability to pay or what their insurance program is, that's an ongoing issue. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Resnick. Thank you for that. And, you know, I ask the questions, and I know they're hard questions because I'm trying to anticipate what we're going to face here in Minnesota. And unless I've missed something, I think the current federal law requires that care providers provide care in emergency situations. But if the situation is not emergent, care providers can and do turn people away. I'm from service. Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the Chair, Dean, any final word on the amendment?
Just two things. First, to the regional aspect of the pilot programs. Currently, Minnesotans are, particularly middle-class Minnesotans in greater Minnesota, are confined in networks that don't work for them right now, that they can't go to the hospital in their town, they can't go to their doctor, they can't go to the clinic that they used to have. So Minnesotans are facing a network crisis immediately and right now. And folks on Medicaid can go to any hospital in the state and immediately present and be treated through the emergency room. That's not the case for the rest of Minnesota, who's living in a very, very different environment right now. And secondarily, I think as we look forward towards payment models and aligning payment with outcomes, it's really, really hard to pull money out of the system in terms of Medicaid spend because it's what sounds great, medical homes and coordinated care sounds really great, sounds like we all want to put our money in that direction. But getting it to actually work and align incentives to money being pulled out of the system is very, very different. And when the financial incentives for the providers, for the hospitals, and for the systems aren't aligned with the best, aren't aligned with actually better healthcare and lower costs, then we're going to get what we got. So we need a little bit of flexibility. So I think it's a good discussion to continue to have and look forward to the help from other folks.
And with that, Representative Dean renews the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE1 amendment is adopted. And Representative Dean now renews his motion that House File 237, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 237, as amended, has been referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Members, the final bill in front of us today is House File 474 by Representative Albright. As he makes his way up front, Representative Albright moves that House File 474 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Albright, we have about 9 minutes. To your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. And Mr. Chair, for the benefit of the committee, this is a technical bill, but I would like to take up the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Albright moves the A1 amendment to get the bill into the form that he wishes. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill actually is a corrective measure that we are undertaking to put into place that which was put into law both unanimously by both bodies in 2015, known as the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. What this bill will permit is for background checks to take place. It will also allow physicians who have passed a federal background, a criminal background check requested by another compact check to be allowed and to obtain an expedited Minnesota license. Mr. Chair and members, for the benefit of the rest of my testimony before the committee, I have Ms. Ruth Martinez with me this morning who can explain the contents of the measure, and I would encourage your support of this bill.
Ms. Martinez, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. My name is Ruth Martinez. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. Appreciate the opportunity to offer this clarity about this technical correction and thank the Minnesota Medical Association for their assistance in drafting this bill. This is a technical correction, as you've heard, that will simply clarify the authority in statute for the Board of Medical Practice as a principal state of licensure to conduct a criminal background check. You may know that under Chapter 214.075, we do criminal background checks for new applicants. This would clarify that we may do this required criminal background check through the compact for current licensees who have identified Minnesota as a principal state of licensure, thereby allowing those individuals to obtain expedited licenses across state lines. It also has an exemption for those coming in from member states for expedited licensure, as they will have had a criminal background check in another principal state of licensure that is not Minnesota, and therefore not have to repeat a criminal background check pursuant to Chapter 214.075.
All right, questions for Ms. Martinez? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, questions for the author. Final comments, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your consideration of House File 474.
And with that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 474, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 474, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.